Very excited about today's show. We have three great guests, as well as my co-host, D.R. Tucker, joining us for the first segment, which will be speaking with Max Boykoff. He's written a book called Who Speaks for the Climate? Making Sense of Media Reporting on Climate Change. Can't wait to have that conversation. In our second segment, we'll speak with the organizer of a big rally planned for this Saturday in Washington, D.C. It's the Frack Attack. If you haven't heard about it, Jennifer Krill, who is the organizer, will tell us all about what you can do to participate, or if you're not going to be there, how you can lend your support. Lend your voice. And in the last segment, we'll be speaking with David Sobel. He's written a fabulous article called Look, Don't Touch, The Problem with Environmental Education, How Our Kids Are Not Getting Away from Their Computers and Getting Out and Playing in the Grass and What the Consequences of That Are. He wrote a first-person piece about conversation and situations that happened with his own children. So very enlightening, and we'll have that in the last segment. But right now, without further delay, I want to welcome D.R. Tucker, my co-host, and also Max Boykoff to the Green Front.
Thank you for having me.
I am so excited about your book because I have been focused on media coverage of environment and climate change in particular for 15 years. I did not get to read all of your book. I skipped through it. I was disappointed that you didn't cover our show because I've been out there not well-known, I know, but interviewing green leaders all these years. Whenever I do see surveys of coverage, I see TV and print. Why is radio overlooked? And I'm not going to dwell on that, but I just thought that might be a place to start, and I don't mean to be giving you a hard time. I'm really thrilled with your research and can't wait to ask you about Obama and how he is not mentioning climate change and what that means for the issue.
Yeah, well, thank you, Betsy. And also to you, DR, it's great to be on the show and have the opportunity to talk about these issues with the two of you just for a bit. I think you're right. I mean, there are a lot of ways in which the research community doesn't adequately respond quickly enough to some of these issues. I mean, this is a dynamic issue, as your Green News Rundown talked about, so much happening in the science and policy fronts, and particularly how those formal spaces then translate to people's everyday lives. How we live our lives, how we work, play, and relax in modern life is very much influenced by the changing climate. And, to get to your question about the research, we in the social sciences largely have gravitated towards looking at newspapers for a few reasons. One of them, I suppose, very practical, is just that the archives are more readily available, that you can conduct certain types of analyses that aren't otherwise available as widely in the transcripts of radio or in television. So that is changing. But then also, second, these are very much largely driving a lot of the policy priorities, and there's been a number of studies that have been done to talk about, what are staffers grabbing onto to set the policy agenda, to set the policy priorities for those folks, not only in Congress, but, in different elected offices and different leadership positions around the United States. And so our work has gravitated towards newspapers. I've expanded into television. There's been some work done on radio, but, you're right that we need to do a lot more. And it's not only that, but we need to do a lot more work nowadays, looking into new and social media influences, and that's something that I'm taking up as a big part of my research agenda for the next 5 years. There's also one other dimension to this that I think is worth pointing out is, as you move from urban spaces to rural spaces, the consumption of radio news changes quite a lot. As you move from maybe developed countries, for lack of a better term, to developing countries, that changes too. I mean, radio is such an important fabric of rural communities in developing countries that there has been some work that's been done by the Panos Institute out of London, by the International Institute for Environment and Development, to look at how people are covering these issues on radio and how that influences the spectrum of possibility in the public mind about what can be done about it. But we need to be doing more, and I'm sorry that I didn't explicitly point out your work over the many years as well in my book.
Well, I guess I wasn't so much looking for a plug, although I guess we do plug ourselves because we seem to be the best-kept secret on the Internet. But having been on radio for 25 years, it is kind of the bastard stepchild of media. So it's kind of an overall problem. And then those of us who have been trying to bring green content to mainstream media and have struggled to get mainstream media, programmers and managers to say yes, thinking it's somehow a fringe or marginal special interest group that would be listening have really, you know, struggled. And then so we hear all these complaints about media's not covering it. And it's like, we're trying, some of us,
yeah.
But we need to get a mainstream platform. But the powers that be just have not seen the, you know, value of that, and it's been quite frustrating. So I'm over that now. We'll go on. But just
well, I think one other
to not overlook radio and also internet. You know, there is so much happening there, but it's also a bit self-selecting, the internet, I say. You know, mostly people who are passionate about the environment tend to listen, and that's why it's important to be on a mainstream general audience platform.
Yep, I agree. And one of the things that I suppose part of your comments are pointing out is just that mass media are very, you know, are varied, that a lot of people talk about, well, mass media this, mass media that. There are a lot of different dimensions, nuances. There's a lot of texture involved. You can say that it's been covered in one way, but that can just conflate a debate, whereas you know, you've been covering these issues for many years and providing, you know, more amplified attention to those outlets, to those programs, I think is an important part of all this.
And I know DR wants to ask a question, but one of the questions I would ask, you know, who speaks for the climate, who's listening is the other part of that question. And
yeah.
I want DR to jump in, but then let's take a look at, you know, what you found when you wrote your book, which was published last year. And then, of course, we've had, you know, a wave of tidal wave of extreme weather events and how you see things changing. But go ahead, DR.
Yes, Max, it's great to talk to you. In your research, have you uncovered any evidence of reporters feeling explicit or implicit pressure not to connect the dots between extreme weather events, climate change, and the burning of fossil fuels?
Yeah, I think to answer your question directly, yes. I mean, but as I open up to that, there are a lot of subtleties that are involved. I think I haven't at least been privy to explicit mandates coming down to not connect those dots. There are a lot of subtleties involved, and so, you know, you can get a journalist who is, you know, doing important work, really has a sense of the beat, which is difficult in this day and age where there's so many demands put on journalists with short time to deadline, many other stories to cover, but they're often swimming upstream against larger political economic currents. And so it can be maybe those larger political economic currents that are working against them being able to swim upstream to connect those dots. And so I think the answer is yes. And there are many different mechanisms and many different factors that are involved that I walk through in the various chapters of my book to help lay out that argument. And I really appreciated the chance to be able to write this book, because it does take some time to lay that out, to talk about, well, why aren't journalists being able to cover these issues more comprehensively, with more context, with more texture? What are the factors that are involved?
And I wanted to mention, because I neglected to at the top, that you are on the faculty in the Department of Environmental Studies at University of Colorado at Boulder, and we had to wait about 6 months for you to be out of class and available during the summer months to join us. So I'm especially pleased to have you on now. Tell us then what you found, just sort of broad strokes, in terms of who is speaking for the climate, and what some of the, you know, resistance is, in addition to potential conflict of interest with entities like MSNBC that might be sponsored by a big oil company like Exxon, not to mention any names, but also, you know, who is doing a better job. And then let's look at, you know, separately what's happened in just the last few weeks with the avalanche of news about the weather.
Yeah, I mean, there are many contradictions. There's a lot of internal inconsistencies that are involved. When you're talking about the production of media representations of climate change, you know, there are so many different aspects of it. We could focus on whether the climate is changing, where there is a great deal of convergent agreement. There's been consensus, if you will, or there's been a solid center of agreement within relevant expert communities that the climate is changing, that humans play a role. But as you move into some of these other issues, such as those that have cropped up more recently about the connections between weather and climate, heat waves and droughts and climate change, it becomes much more difficult to extract the signal amongst noise and natural variation. So the story to cover that becomes a lot more difficult. And there are many factors that are involved. I mean, I talked for just a second there about the political economy, that journalists are fighting to provide news that satisfies their news organization's interests, that garners attention for a variety of reasons that can shape the story. There are also cultural aspects. I mean, we're dealing with something that is often very abstract. So when we come across a heat wave, a dramatic event, or when somebody speaks out about it, somebody speaks for the climate, some kind of personality, that provides the news hook for the coverage. The trouble with that sometimes is that, you know, in looking at those specific events, and, you know, this is a very logical thing that happens, but looking at those specific events, we can focus in on the atomized event, the atomized individual, and overlooking some of the distracting from maybe some of the institutional and structural challenges that exist over longer time horizons, over the longer term. You know, and by that I mean the importance of decarbonizing our industry and our society, that there are all kinds of benefits that can come from that, that don't just relate back to climate change. And that a lot of the coverage that comes out then just focuses on individual behavioral changes as some kind of fashion or fad. You know, individuals changing light bulbs, they're seductive, we can change the, save the environment, but it can come oftentimes at the cost of these larger scale and long-term challenges.
Max, has the rise of opinion journalism played a role in the spread of climate disinformation?
Yeah. Ask that again, sorry?
I said, has the rise of opinion journalism played a role in the spread of climate misinformation?
Well, I'd say that has played a role, but opinion journalism is, you know, a bit of a cultural aspect as well. In the United States, the firewall between straight news reporting and opinion journalism traditionally has been in newspapers, has been very clear. Whereas over in the UK, where I spent 3 years, it's not so much. But the readership that's involved or the cultural context is there's a better understanding that there is this opinion-led journalism. And so it does play a role in the spread of disinformation, as you say. But I'd say that it isn't something that's necessarily new. I mean, but then when you look back at the United States context, which may be part of your thinking and your question here, is that, you know, CNN has been atrophying in terms of their viewership, and they've taken up what has been considered to be this central neutral stance, whereas MSNBC has been gaining viewers, and maybe from the right-wing persuasion, Fox has certainly played an important role in speaking for the climate in particular ways. And by that I mean by amplifying certain outlier perspectives, And that can oftentimes be this spread of disinformation about not just the fundamentals of climate science, that humans are playing a role, but then also the more the prognoses about what are the most appropriate, feasible, desirable policy actions to be taking in the face of this great challenge.
Well, and of course, DR and I are of the strong belief that you know, those the big you know, guns on Fox, Hannity, O'Reilly, and then on Radio Rush, Limbaugh and company, they're actively, you know, mocking anyone who is a scientist or environmentalist or an activist and denying the science. And they're going to look pretty stupid pretty quickly here because Americans are beginning to connect the dots. But I don't think you can overlook the fact that 95% of all talk radio is ultra-conservative, and those people are not the ones that are saying we have a problem and we need to do something about it, putting it mildly. And there's nothing on the other end in radio or television that is, you know, day in, day out reporting on the scientific facts and, you know, weather developments and political, you know, players. All that it's missing. And I do think that has something to do with the high numbers of Americans that still have doubt. And, you know, all you have to do is look out your window or look at the news or the weather. And, you know, how can you have doubt, really? So I really do think they should take some of the blame.
Yeah, you could be right. I mean, some of the very early work that I had done on this over a decade ago now that was looking at how mass media in the United States have been covering whether humans contribute to climate change or not. While there had been this convergent agreement within the expert communities that humans are playing a role along with natural variation, my brother, Jules Boykoff, who's at Pacific University, he and I had first looked at just, well, how is that being covered? And we found there was this significant divergence, and that's one of the findings that I talk about in the book, that mass media had been relying on what we consider to be this balanced perspective, this he said, she said. Well, 97%, there's Bill Anderegg and colleagues have come up with the number 97% of scientists, relevant experts, agree that humans contribute to climate change, but also then looking for that 3% perspective and amplifying this outlier view within the U.S. media. Now, in the U.S. media, in newspapers and in television are the two places where I had done this empirical research, the focus had been on this balancing norm, looking for the multiple perspectives. But I'd been in the UK and understood and started to appreciate a bit more the influence of tabloid journalism over there, and applied the same methods over there to see, well, how had the story been covered in tabloid newspapers? And, you know, just as a quick aside, these tabloid newspapers have a reach that far exceeds by their circulation, The Guardian, The Independent, The Telegraph, you know, 10, 12 times the circulation on a daily basis of The Sun and The Daily Mail. But I'd found over there that it wasn't necessarily this balancing norm, but actually it was just the proliferation of these contrarian perspectives, that it was folks such as Jeremy Clarkson, who has this BBC Auto program, who writes columns for The Sun oftentimes, really dismissing the science and this convergent agreement and the evidence about the science of climate change. So that may get to your point that on talk radio, you know, if one were to take a look at that, it might be less about this journalistic norm of balance, but more about the amplification of this contrarian view of these outlier perspectives that then shapes public opinion. I mean, we talked about in early days this balance as informational bias, but it's really the amplification of contrarian views as providing this informationally biased perspective that then, you know, constrains people's ability to make these decisions and have a view on, well, what should be done about it.
Is the problem of false balance getting worse in the American press, and is there any way we can get the American press to take what I call the Chris Hayes approach and stop providing false balance? To use an old analogy that I saw in the Boston Phoenix years ago, reporters don't get quotes from the KKK when they're doing stories about affirmative action, so why are they quoting climate deniers when they're doing stories about climate change?
Yep. It is, some of the work that I talk about in the book is that in the top newspapers, it is improving, and that it has improved. I looked at the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and LA Times, and found that it had improved. There are questions about whether it had similarly improved in television, but now that we're moving into this era of more opinion journalism, of new and social media influences, it remains an open question. And the Chris Hayes approach, I think, is a laudable one. It's not to abandon this journalistic norm of balance, of course, but it's rather to apply it more discerningly as balance as accuracy rather than just balance as multiple perspectives. So to go to using the context, to go to where are the, where are the different voices on this topic, as they are represented in the larger community. And I think that that's the approach that is much more effective, that translates to accuracy and fairness when it comes to covering these issues. I mean, like you say with the KKK, I've heard this applied to, you know, gravity, that they don't look for other perspectives on that, or the Flat Earth Society for the other view. The challenge there is that, you know, we're dealing with a very complex, dynamic system, and one of the misperceptions about all this is that we can reduce uncertainty to the point that it will then be clear what is the action or what are the sets of actions that are needed to deal with this problem effectively, and we won't get there. I mean, this is an ongoing, dynamic, highly uncertain, highly contentious, and very politicized issue that then creates that space for those folks to walk in and maybe raise the specter of doubt, sometimes very deliberately, but then, you know, sometimes logically. We have questions about these things. We ought to be able to ask them, but we also ought to be open to the answers that are coming from the scientific community.
Well, that's just it. I mean, it's one thing to improve the coverage and really shine the spotlight as it needs to be on the challenges we face, you know, climate change being the mother of all our ecological challenges, making, you know, drier places drier and wetter, and all the extremes we're seeing. But overall, just for a moment, take, you know, back up a bit and look at recent research that showed only 1% of all news coverage is of environmental stories, and that would include climate change, and yet 79% of those same 1,000 people polled said they would like to see environmental coverage improved. Now, I suspect in the last you know, this month in July, because of all the records that have been broken, that there is, they are starting to connect the dots. We've seen that with some meteorologists and some, you know, networks covering it better, but I'm sure it's still, you know, maybe under 5%, and considering that celebrity news gets just as much coverage, and considering, you know, the really dire, you know, prognoses for our planet and those of us who hope to, you know, have children and grandchildren and beyond, you know, thriving here, it's a really inadequate ratio. I'm sure you agree. A quick comment on that, if you will, and then just in the last few minutes, if you could talk about your piece that you wrote for the Washington Post about the dangerous shift in Obama's climate change rhetoric, how talking about clean energy only and not climate change really does a disservice to the issue.
Yeah, I mean, I think your comments are really good there, and I agree. I mean, it's just difficult because we are dealing with such a long-term, obviously global challenge that when we scale it down to our daily lives, many people have other things to worry about, you know, quality of water, food on the table, quality of education for their kids. There are many more acute and concentrated challenges. And so one of these, unless it hits you in terms of your vulnerability to some of the associated impacts around climate change that have, you know, where the scientific evidence is improving on that, that it is something that can be maybe deprioritized in your life. And as news continue to also deprioritize that on the news agenda, then that gives folks just yet one more reason. And, you know, that is logical in a way, but that it's also something that needs to improve in terms of connecting these dots, in terms of making these, making the interacting effects more apparent to the general public. So I think, you know, I certainly agree with your comments there. As far as the opinion piece that I wrote in January about Obama's climate rhetoric, is one of the things that I was just pointing out is that the more that the Obama administration talks about climate change as clean energy, the more constrained that maybe that spectrum of possible policy action becomes. And so questions about land use change, questions about other associated environmental changes get then reduced to this question of renewable energies. And so what I was trying to say is that the Obama administration, in my view, needed to be bold that when they were talking about climate change, not to cloak it in these other terms in order to make it a bit more amenable to the policy community there in D.C. and elsewhere. Because ultimately, we need to have all possibilities on the table, and that when the time comes where this is addressed, and when it needs to be addressed, that if we allow ourselves to be moving down this road of more constrained rhetoric, then we'll find that our options are more limited.
Well, I think we're just about out of time, DR, unless you have a last quick question.
Oh, no, I just wanted to thank Max for joining us.
Yes, and I do the same, Max. And who speaks for the climate? Well, we are speaking about solutions to climate change, having long believed that we have a challenge here. So perhaps in your next view of the scanning the media landscape, don't forget about the few of us who are out there talking to experts on the green front lines who are solving the issues and offering solutions and not getting out there at all anywhere in mainstream media now that Americans are starting to wake up to the fact that, oh, gee, we may have a problem. What the heck do we do about it? Well, there's lots of very fascinating, knowledgeable, passionate people who have, if not answers, at least steps we can start taking and, in fact, must. So maybe that'll be the next book.
Yeah. Point taken. Well, thank you both for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Max. And I just want to give your official title here because I neglected to do that. The top assistant professor in the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research at the University of Colorado at Boulder. In my next life, I want to come back and be a student there and study with you. Thanks so much, Max Boykoff.
Right.
When we come back after a quick break, we're going to talk to Jennifer Krill. She's organizing the frack attack on the Capitol this weekend. And after that, we'll take a look at why kids are not interacting with nature enough and what that portends for our future. You're listening to The Green Front. Welcome back to The Green Front.